the body of one of the attackers. He was picked up on the runway at the airport. The autopsy categorically excludes an extraterrestrial being. His molecular structure clearly establishes him as a member of the human race.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
You got for me or no?
A girl died here about a month ago. Were you the one?
On phone. Lightning.
No, heart attack. Did you see...
No heart attack. She on phone. Born by lightning. You tease me?
Lightning.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 204, 1981's Bells, a.k.a. Murder by Phone. Or as I wrote it up on my review on the site, Scanners for Dummies.
Interesting.
This is Canadian. This features technology that remotely kills people, but it's safe to say we're not remotely interested in this movie.
Well, I mean, the thing I'm most interested in is the fact that you said 1981, because I, according to IMDb, this was an 82 release.
Oh, okay.
So if that's the extent of our debate.
The extent of our attention to detail when it comes to this movie.
Anyway, 81, 82, it doesn't matter. This is another one of a long litany of tax shelter movies that were made in our fair country in the late 70s and early 80s, where the government wanted to promote film production.
Canadian culture with capital C.
So they offered a tax rebate to American producers that if they were to come to Canada to shoot their film, they would receive a rebate.
Enticements.
Enticements, yeah, exactly. Tax breaks and so on. So we had a litany of horror films, and the rules are pretty lax. All they had to do was have 2/3 Canadian crew and 1 Canadian actor, and they could bring in your token American actors. In this case, we have John Houseman.
Yes,
we have the great John Houseman. Who
the great John Houseman. Is that good?
Alec Berg. Alec Berg. It's a great John Houseman name, Alec Berg. And we have the great Richard Chamberlain. So, yeah, murder.
Dr. Kildare himself.
Dr. Kildare himself. Rich Man, Poor Man. Was he in that?
I'm not sure.
I believe that was a miniseries in the 80s. My mother watched quite intently. I'm not the biggest expert on the oeuvre of Richard Chamberlain. What I do know is, as a child, the first time that I was ever allowed to go see a movie in the cinema with just my friends, it was a matinee. It was at the Promenade Mall in Thornhill. It was a Richard Chamberlain film. It was and it was a canon movie too. It was King Solomon's Mines.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
I've seen that as well.
I was 13, and his co-star in that was, I believe, Sharon Stone, a young Sharon Stone. So it was either King Solomon's Mines or its sequel, Alan Quatermain and the Lost City of Gold, and that's a film I want to discuss on the podcast one of these days.
Either or.
Unfortunately, we're not just discussing either or.
Ryder Haggard, if I'm not mistaken, was the author of the source material. It was a Penguin classic.
Alan Quartermain, yep.
Alan Quartermain, I think I'm getting it right.
Oh, it was.
God, that's a blast from the past.
Yeah.
First movie I saw was Crawl in the cinema.
No, but so, I'm talking with your friends. Like, no parentals, nothing.
Oh, wow.
This is the first movie.
Not a bad choice.
The first movie I ever saw in the cinema was Pinocchio, but it was my parents, and I was like 3.
Yeah. Oh, it makes sense.
But this was when I was 13. My mother said, you know what? You could spend a day in the mall. Here's $20. And I just went hog wild. I mean, $20 in, you know, the late 80s, you can go nuts. You could see a matinee. You could buy a cassette. You could go to the food court and pig out on like McDonald's or Taco Bell or whatever the heck you want.
You could buy 2 cassettes.
You could buy 2, exactly. They had the $3.99 bargain bin. And I saw King Solomon's Mines. And it was thoroughly entertaining, and I would love to revisit it. However, as I said earlier, we're not revisiting that one. Instead, you made me visit Bells, a.k.a. Murder by Phone. And I got to say, I mean, we're going to talk about this movie and dissect it to the best of our abilities, but there's really not that much to dissect. It's not...
Well, I was thinking about technology when I was watching this, because I was trying to think of something to talk about. And this is a movie that shows the perils of...
trying to like focus on one type of technology, and it's immediately outdated.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
The telecom. Look at this fancy facility, this company. What were they called? This company, I forget. When they have a $450 billion facility, and they can handle like how many calls a minute, like per second, is this ridiculous thing.
I mean, this entire movie is one big anachronism. I mean, it's all about telecom and landlines and fiber optic cables that are, and then there's just like this weird like ecological message that they try to shoehorn in.
It's almost like an animal attack movie in that regard.
I mean,
it's a phone attack.
Richard Chamberlain plays a professor.
Mm-hmm.
Who, by the name of
Nat Bridger. He's bridging the two worlds of technology. I don't know what he's doing. He's
and
bridging something.
Apparently, it seems like he's a science professor, but at the same time, we don't really see him in class that much, doing a lesson. But he's esteemed to a certain extent because his mentor, John Houseman, is always riding him for not having anything published recently and so on.
Publish or perish.
But sinister things are afoot in the great city of Toronto, Ontario, Canada.
Exactly.
That being our city. And the movie does begin tremendously. We find ourselves at Museum Station. It's the Toronto Transit Commission, the TTC, that you and I use every day to get to and from our jobs.
North America's best transit system.
Now, one of the things that first struck me was the fact that here we are at Museum Station, and there's really not a soul in sight. There's a bag lady, and then there's the woman that ends up picking up the phone. I mean, that's completely... It doesn't matter what time of day you are. There's always going to be people waiting for the subway, but they must have just taken it over and didn't pay any extras, and the subway station was destitute. So, they had some hooligans there that's kind of like establishing, okay, this is a subway station. But this
is a rough urban milieu.
This
we
is
have to have hooligans.
This is Toronto in 82. This is not New York City. There was not one speck of graffiti. Everything was clean as a whistle. And I do recall in the early 80s, our subways were not as clean as they are today, but they must have scrubbed them clean for this movie.
Definitely. And so we get this phone that's ringing at a public telephone.
It's a payphone.
Yeah.
A payphone.
Why would you? I mean, at the best of times when we actually used a cell, I can't even say the word, a payphone, I wouldn't want to touch them as they're so gross, as they continue to be gross. Sometimes as a kid, you'd reach in and try and find like coins.
One of those, yes.
Yeah, and it was like, oh, this one pays out, and I'm going to go back to it. And I remember getting like $2 or $3 out of them and stuff. But touching the receiver that someone else's gross face has been touching, it's a hotbed for bacteria.
One of the most traumatic incidences of my entire life.
Oh, I got to hear this.
Involved a payphone. Oh my God, I never thought I would share this, especially not to our millions and millions of listeners. But this is really, really, really disgusting, embarrassing, traumatic. I got to set the scene here. So, 14 years old, 15, 16, what have you. I'm in high school. And I have a job at Pizza Hut. That was my part-time job. And I ended up moving, because this was Pizza Hut in Richmond Hill, where we went to high school, where we both lived. But I ended up moving to another suburb, Thornhill, which is about 45 minutes away. And in order to get to my job at Pizza Hut, I would have to, because, we have our Toronto Transit Commission, which is pretty reliable, and the buses come pretty quickly, but back in the day, the regional transit in the suburbs was very unreliable, and you had the GO Transit, which was the bus I needed to take to get to my job, but to get to that stop, I had to take the Thornhill Transit, and that is, like, a bus would come once every hour, and I would have to time everything to the nth degree to make sure that I'm not waiting too long, and if I get off here, if I run fast enough, I'll get my connecting Bayview bus so I can make my way to Pizza Hut. So I had a shift. It was in December. I remember that because it was on Christmas break, and I think my shift was probably about 1 o'clock or so, and I'm on the Thornhill bus, and sometimes these drivers on the Thornhill bus, I don't know what the fuck they just want to fuck with you. Because not only were they riding a bus that would only run once every hour, but you're on the bus, they refuse to press the gas pedal. So the thing would be going at a snail's pace. I'm like, come on, come on, come on, I gotta get my connecting bus. I literally have like a 2-minute window, or else I'm gonna be, because the other bus only comes once an hour, and I'm gonna be late for work. So I finally get off the stop, and I get off the stop where I'm gonna get my connecting Bayview bus, and I'm being very specific here. This was at Yonge and Steeles. And as I get to the corner, I have to walk about a block to get the GO bus, the Bayview bus. Well, I get to the corner, I see the bus going. It was early, and instead of staying, it just left. So I was going to be late for work, and I didn't expect another bus to come. So there was a payphone there, and I'm already starting to like convulse just to talk about the story. I'm like, okay, well, I better call into work, tell them I'm going to be late. So I pick up the receiver, I put it to my ear. I didn't even put a quarter in at this point, and I feel something on my ear. And I take away the receiver. I'm like, okay, this better not be what I think it is. I look at the receiver in my hand. It was coated in human feces.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Oh.
And it was all over my ear. Okay? So now the story continues. All of a sudden, I turn my head to the left, and another bus is coming. And I have this decision to make. Do I get on the bus for a 20-minute ride where we're going to have an ear covered in human feces? Or do I let it go and have to wait another hour and be late for work? What would you do?
A shitty experience, literally. Oh, my God. Well, I guess it depends what you're wearing. And if you had, maybe I would hopefully grab a scarf and wipe it off, or a hat and just...
I had nothing.
Oh, my God.
I got on the bus. And I rode for about 20, 30 minutes, like literally holding in my puke, you know, wondering what the people around. I know. Oh, I know.
It's even when you step in like dog shit, the smell is.
This was the most disgusting. Like, I don't know if it was animal. I say human feces. It could have been. It was just feces. Yeah. It was some fucker smeared feces on the earpiece of that phone so that some sucker like me can get, you know, pranked, but good. So I finally make it to work. I'm on the verge of just like puking my guts out. I run to the washroom. I scrub my ear 30, 40 times with like industrial soap. But I'm telling you, that was probably the last time I ever picked up a payphone. They weren't long for this world, but that was the last time I ever. And I even called Bell, which is, you know, they operate on the phone. And I reported it. Like, okay, well, I'm really sorry, sir. We'll send someone to clean it. But the damage was done. So yeah, that was one of the most traumatic incidents of my life. And I can't believe I just said this for all of us to hear. But that was preferable to what happened to the lady. So good segue to the lady.
Yeah, it's a good segue because this movie is all about a guy trying to figure out how phones are getting serviced because this lady in the station gets zapped.
Yeah, so the phone is ringing.
Killed by a phone.
And she picks up the phone. It's a random call. She doesn't know who it's from. Hello? And then what happens?
Yeah, because she starts to shake. She has like kind of a... I forget the different details of the death.
She's bleeding from her eyes. Yeah. She's bleeding from all the orifices in her face. She starts to convulse.
And then that's when we got the sense that this may have been like a really exciting movie at the time.
Yeah, because then there's a surge of electricity and she gets blown backwards. You wrote about this for a book.
Yeah, I did indeed. Yeah, she gets blown backwards and there's a one witness, which is again this vagrant lady. And this woman is...
Who was the cleanest looking bag lady. She had two bags. They called her Bag Lady.
She was a Toronto Bag Lady.
She didn't even have
she was pristine.
Yeah,
Toronto the good. So yeah, essentially the rest of this movie is this environmental activist / professor who is trying to get to the bottom of what's going on.
Well, the connection is that this lady that was blitzed at the beginning of the movie was a former student of his,
a fine pupil,
and he was just happening to go to Toronto for some sort of conference. He was going to meet his mentor Stanley, played by the great John Houseman, and, you know, go to a few seminars and whatnot, and also play a little investigation and investigate what would happen to a student. And of course these killings with the same sort of MO continue.
And the police in this initial killing chalk it up to a heart attack, and Dr. Bridger says, protests saying this is impossible. This is an undergrad co-ed. She was what, 20 years old or whatever, a grad student, 25 tops. There's no way she's succumbing to, you know, cardiovascular incident.
And it should be noted that the receiver, the phone, was blown to bits. The phone company even came and replaced it. So I mean, they know that it was a heart attack, but because they have no leads, they're just chalking up to a heart attack.
Where does that take us then? Big company. And one of its disgruntled employees. So what you have here is this.
You just spoiled the whole movie.
Yeah. Oh, crap. Yeah.
Like nobody could see that coming, right?
Yeah, and it just so happens through various machinations that, geez, I forget how they meet, but I think Richard Chamberlain, who is famously, I guess, you know, came out of the closet, yeah, famously gay.
Not at that point, but he's very... I mean, he was gay, but he wasn't out of the closet. Yeah, he was in the closet, yeah.
And he's, you know, kind of a dashing fellow, rocking sort of a early 80s Chuck Norris kind of beard and hairdo. And he connects with an official at the telecom company. If I'm not mistaken, maybe she was an artist.
She was painting a mural of some sort at the telephone company.
And of course they hit it off.
While he goes there on the pretense of taking a tour, they're giving, like, who would go on a guided tour of a telecom company? I have no clue. It sounds like some god-awful field trip that we'd be taken on in, like, grade 10.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I remember they took us to the Honda assembly plant one time.
Well, at least that would be interesting. True. Like, the telecom, it's like, here, look at these capacitors and transistors, and look at this fiber optic cable. It's phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. And naturally, he breaks away from the tour, and he, you know, pitches woo to this lady, and he's going to places he clearly has no... It's like he has carte blanche of this entire... headquarters. He's able to walk around and investigate.
Yeah, and ask all these very pointed, pertinent questions as to what was going on, and then, of course, to try and glean more information as to what project they're working on, and who's working on what, and why the phone, I guess, was replaced so abruptly at Museum Subway Station, which, you know, again, even back in the day, these things would be in a state of disrepair for weeks and weeks at a time while they got all sorts of manner of shit on them.
You know, I had to call to report that shit. Oh. And if I didn't call and report it, it was probably because I didn't want another person to go through what I went through. Mm. So I was doing my, you know, my best good Samaritan, but because I didn't want anybody else. It was, dude, I can't.
It's so weird that you mentioned this, because I almost got into a fight with two guys on Roncesvalles in the West End, Toronto, one of whom was using a phone and I couldn't, and I had an important call to make, and I was banging on the door the booth, and the guy
You're pulling like a George Costanza, like, I gotta call Vandal Industries, save Vandal.
And the guy beside him, his buddy, said, you better stop doing that and let him finish. And I yelled at him, saying, like, you're scum and your friend is scum. And I don't know what got into me.
He was just talking on the phone.
It was like I needed to make a call. He was like, are you going to be done? Like, I was patiently waiting. And the guy was like,
the call that was so important?
I don't know.
You're banging on some poor guys.
It's amazing. But even, and this is aging us now, but I remember.
We've aged ourselves enough.
Yeah, I guess.
There's no worries about that.
I can't remember if it was in Nerdist or an article in Wired where they actually. Like the author actually put a explanation in squared brackets as to what a payphone is, and I thought, my God, like, this is something with which people growing up are not the slightest bit familiar. And but that's what makes this so funny, because the phone had been around, the landline, for what, 80 years at the time this was going, we got to get on this cutting edge. We got to make a phone movie.
As a murder implement, I mean, we've seen many movies where the killer will use the phone as part of his MO, but not to kill somebody, but to threaten them.
Yeah, or bash them on the head to knock them out, but never to kill them.
But how many movies, you know, Black Christmas, New York Ripper,
etc.,
where the killer calls and the calls come from the house or what have you.
Calls, yeah.
But never before has somebody managed to send some sort of electrical bolt through the phone, which is going to fry people's neurons and synapses and send them going. And not just payphones, too, but, you know, home phones as well. Because later on, we see people in the comfort of their own abode and the phone rings. Hello, and all of a sudden they start convulsing and they get blown backwards and they get blown through, you know, their
windows. Plate glass window as well. There's some really, really pretty cool deaths, and I thought this was a bit of a wasted opportunity.
Every
I
think death it's a... was fun. Oh, everything yeah. else was boring as fuck.
Well, it was too procedurally based, and I think they tried to insert like a greater good ethos or message, like Global Village type. This guy's an environmentalist, and that's frequently used again in animal attack movies, where, you know, something is happening and it's a caveat, a foreboding of how technology could change. But I thought this was a wasted opportunity, because it would be really neat to remake this now and have some sort of, I mean, they've tried, but you have some sort of app that, you know, could kill people. I think it's fascinating to be beholden to a technology that could kill us. I think there's a kernel of a good idea, but really, like, this sort of the sophisticate just wandering around, and like Richard Chamberlain is not particularly good in this role. Houseman is kind of fun, but it's just a guy walking around trying to like asking questions, and that part's not particularly handled well.
The procedural part was extremely dull. Mm-hmm. The murders are great. The idea is cool, and I think what the filmmakers intended was this to be some sort of cautionary tale about technology, and we have to
75 years too late.
Yeah.
You know, Watson, can I hear you? Oh, like in 80 years they'll make a movie warning about the telephone. Like, yeah. Good God.
Hey, you know, it's fitting that this was a Canadian film considering the fact that Alexander Graham Bell is a Canadian.
And yeah, if I'm not mistaken, I think Scott's born, but you know, came to Canada, and also one of our most prominent companies, which a lot of people had investments in. It was a huge multinational company. It went south,
but
and
no,
a lot
actually,
of people lost their
it's
shirts.
Not, but it's rising up again.
It is. Nortel is.
Oh, I'm going to talk about BlackBerry.
Oh well, I could say. Oh, that fits well too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nortel was the precursor. They were like a fiber optic cable company. They were doing battle with Verizon and whoever else in the States, and a lot of people had their pension money tied up in this, what used to be called Northern Telecom, and then it became Nortel. It was a multi-billion-dollar, one of the biggest market cap companies on the planet. It went south because other people took over. I think Celestica ate into their market share. They just went in the tank. And same thing with BlackBerry, which has, if I'm not mistaken,
they started the smartphone, and then they just got...
They got walloped. I think they have 2% market share of the cell phone market, which is pathetic, and they're done.
But like, for some reason, well, they're not done. I mean, for you know, a couple episodes,
self-driving cars.
I'm now dabbling in the stock market here and there, and the stock is actually right. It rose 20% like the last week, so they're coming back somehow.
The self-driving cars is the technology
and
they're involved in. So
I also read that I think it's in some African country, maybe it's Nairobi or something. BlackBerry is number one. Yeah, BlackBerry, some African country.
Good, yeah. good.
That was a statistic I read.
Well, speaking of things we've read, I read that it took, this is a little bit of an aside, but it took 75 years for the landline to make 75% market penetration. For the smartphone, it took 12 years to get 75% of people to own one. Because you always had these weirdos who didn't have a phone. It's like, oh, how do we connect? Mm-hmm. And in horror, especially, we're out at the cottage, we have no phone. So this stuff is ripe for an interesting movie.
Well, I mean, this is a movie that millennials are going to scoff at from the very get-go because it's so anachronistic in the sense, not anachronistic for its time, but it's archaic with your pay phones and your answering machines that actually take cassettes, you know, physical answering machines, not voicemail. No texting, none of that sort of stuff, no Skype. This is actual phone. And like I said before, the concept is very, very cool. But the procedural process, dull as dishwater. However, it is livened up every time John Houseman's on screen. Mm-hmm. I really, like I said, he plays Stanley, he plays the mentor, and he's always ripping Richard Chamberlain. Chamberlain's something like, oh, so I just read your published whatever, you know? And he goes, yes, I'm still waiting for you to publish something. And that stuff was fun.
That was fun, because
John Houseman just got this naturally haughty sort of air about him.
Mean, yeah. Well, but it's funny, though, when you consider or compare and contrast this with Videodrome, which, again, a dated technology, the VHS tape. But that was
a
technology interface that was so much more interesting and still prescient.
But
and
Videodrome
still
feels as fresh as the days of release. I mean, okay, fine. We no longer insert VHSs. We now insert Blu-rays. Okay, maybe it's now becoming digital. But Videodrome still feels vital.
Oh, yeah.
And that's because there were so much more smarts behind it. There was so much, I mean, you know, the McClune-esque philosophy and so on. And that was a movie that also was a cautionary tale about technology, but that was brilliant. This was ham-fisted.
So I guess this is the point in the show where we talk about what we've learned. And I guess I can start here. Bell's Murder by Phone. Let's see. Some fun lines. His Richard Chamberlain's character is this sort of nebulous professor. We don't know what he's professing, but he's clearly an activist. And I think a cop says at one point, go back to the soybean patch. And I was like, oh, you know, you hippie, you granola eating Birkenstock wear or whatever. And then there's another line. It's like, you environmental people. And so everyone's very dismissive of Dr. Bridger. And this is pretty funny. This would have been at the time of the nascent environmental movement. And I think maybe the founding of Greenpeace was in the 70s. So at the time, these people were treated like outliers and freaks. And now it's de rigueur. Everyone is into green and everyone wants to source their things organically. But I got a kick out of that he's so maligned as this, you know, hippie type. So what did you learn?
Oh, there's a few things I learned. First of all, one thing this movie had was a lot of techno babble, you know, such as like
Ohm's Law
or Marx Generator.
I love my techno babble.
And I just went out. I went with it. I mean, they were trying to make it sound a little smarter than what it really was. So there's a lot of techno babble. So that was one thing I learned. But more importantly, one thing I did learn is, it's very interesting when you look at the trajectory of certain directors. And, you know, there's directors like your Scorsese's and your Coppola. Well, I mean, even they have, you know, their downward trajectories. But some directors, like, because this movie was directed by Michael Anderson. Michael Anderson directed Around the World in 80 Days back in 1957. That won Best Picture. He also directed Logan's Run, which is...
Yeah, of all things, yeah.
Well, I mean, that's... you know, a sci-fi genre classic.
For sure.
Everybody I know loves Logan's Run. Mm-hmm. But I guess as the years go by, you know, the films that you get offered or the films that you start to... So it's interesting to see that a man that directed a film that won Best Picture way back in the 50s, in the 80s, is making...
Making Drek like this?
A Tax Shelter movie.
Yeah.
And so I just kind of thought, is this something I should, like, feel sad about? Or no, I mean, you know, it's a trajectory. It happens to every artist.
Well, I was thinking the same thing with John Houseman, who won, I want to say, Best Supporting Actor for The Paper Chase with Timothy Bottoms. And it's like, this guy is... I first heard of him in a comedy sketch, a Canadian... sketch comedy show called SCTV. Mm-hmm. And they had, I believe it was Dave Thomas as John Houseman reading the phone book. And there's that cliche comment that, you know, the best actors can make anything come to light. And then I think it was John Houseman reading from the Mellonville, Ontario, which was the fictional town
that SCTV, yeah.
A. Andrews. B. Burns, that kind of thing. And it's really, really funny. And I didn't know, like, it was like Das Boot, where they would make fun of that German U-boat movie. And I had no idea. I'd never seen Das Boot, but I was laughing my ass off as a little kid. And I didn't know who John Houseman was. And so that was my way of, by way of entry, realizing that this guy is a legitimate talent with this sonorous voice. And an Oscar winner from the 70s appearing in Drek again. And Michael Anderson, again, kudos to keep working. Well, because that's really what you love what you do. You keep doing what you do. Because
I was going to say, as I was looking at Michael Anderson's filmography in IMDb, another film struck me, and that was a film called Separate Vacations, which came out in 86. Now, this was a film that I was taken to go see in the cinema. See, because of the fact that my parents were divorced at a very early... this is a confessional for me. I mean, first time I have pieces in my ear. Whenever my dad would have me for the day, he'd take me to movies. We had nothing else to do other than sit in a darkened theater and watch a movie, right? We had nothing to talk about. So one of the movies was Separate Vacations. And although I don't remember much of the movie, it's sort of been lost to the dustbins of history. I remember enjoying it at the time. So... kudos to Michael Anderson for maintaining a good career for so many years.
Yeah, now, for sure.
The last thing I want to say that I learned, and you were talking about Houseman, and his voice is just the treasure that is John Houseman, because nobody can read a line like this man. Like, at one point, because Dr. Jenkins, or what's his name again? Bridger. He's the house guest of John Houseman, and he goes, "We have... in the fridge, eggs, bread, even, I can't roll my R's. He goes, even granola." Like, the way he read granola was so imbued with gravitas.
Yeah, yeah,
and
exactly.
I've never heard the word granola spoken like that. Granola! It's like, oh my God, Houseman, you can do anything,
yeah.
You know?
He really brings it. Star rating.
Star rating, unfortunately, the concept was fantastic. The execution not so good. I can't in good faith recommend this movie, but at the same time, it's something that you kind of almost have to see it just to sort of say, hey, that's that movie where
people phones kill people.
So I'm going to say, I don't know, one and three quarters.
All right, I'm going to give it a solid 2.5, but you're probably best hanging up on this one. But do check out our podcast, back to once a week, and I think we're the better for it, too. Every Friday, new episodes, www.reallyawfulmovies.com. If you have a film suggestion in a genre space, do let us know. Reallyawfulmovies@gmail.com, and we will talk to you soon.
Take care.